everyone, and welcome to Histories of the Unexpected.
He's the famous historical adventurer Dr. Sam Willis.
He is Professor Extraordinaire of Early Modern British History at Plymouth University. He's Professor James Daybell.
Hello, Sam.
Hello, James.
Are you well?
Very well.
Good.
Thank you. It's slightly an intrusive question, that, though, because we're doing privacy.
I like where you're going with that. Very good.
This is Histories of the Unexpected. It's a show where we demonstrate that everything, even the most unexpected of subjects, has a history.
Like water, porter, or slaughter, or even, and I'm really pleased with this, Zits, the Blitz, and Colditz.
Very good.
Colditz is all about handkerchiefs.
As are Zits.
Yes, yes. And I imagine the Blitz. People had handkerchiefs during the Blitz. All of them are about handkerchiefs.
And everything links together in unexpected ways, doesn't it, James? Which is why handkerchiefs are about the Blitz.
Yes. Who knew, for example, Sam? Who knew that chimneys were, in fact, all about the Industrial Revolution, superstition, Father Christmas, childhood dreams and innocence, fairies, goblins, shoes, and smickling?
Let's come back to smickling later.
Smickling. It's all about fertility and shoes and treading in the shoes of a recently pregnant woman who's given birth and hoping that yourself will have a child, and then somehow shoes go up chimneys.
Fertility and shoes and chimneys.
Yes.
Anyway, this week we're going to do privacy. We're on a bit of a theme, aren't we?
We are. I'm giving a talk on the private lives of Tudor women this week, which is why we're thinking about this.
Hmm. Well, I mean, one of the things that struck me immediately was that privacy is very linked to secrets, because you want to be keeping your secrets private, don't you? You don't want them discovered. It is very similar.
Yep, yep.
But there's much more to it, isn't there?
And there's ways of thinking about, you know, how do we conceptualise private? So private spaces versus public spaces.
Yeah, communal.
You know, state secrets versus private secrets. The kinds of things that the way in which you think about privacy, technologies of privacy. So in keeping things private, we looked in our last podcast at furniture and boxes and secret cabinets. But think about how people keep ideas or emotions private. So it opens up a whole world for us.
That idea of state secrets and privacy makes me think of Samuel Pepys, particularly, where he's a good person for that, with his A, because he's got his diaries, B, because he had a significant role as a Secretary of the Navy for so many years, but was also a very private person, but then weirdly wasn't a private person because he told everyone about his privacy in his diary.
Yes.
That's a strange thing, isn't it?
Although it is in shorthand, so it's in a kind of code, and it had to be translated.
Yeah, and so it also does come back to diaries, whether people are writing diaries to record their private thoughts or whether they're writing diaries to record their private thoughts so that they may be shared later.
Yeah, there's this real sort of tension, isn't there, between historical documents that are ostensibly private,
yeah,
correspondence, diaries, journals, but that survive. And it's whether people intend them to survive.
Yeah.
And it's what happens to them afterwards. Often what happens is somebody has kept a private journal or private correspondence. Correspondence often goes to other people. Well, it always goes to other people who have then kept it. A lot of private documents may pass into the hands of family upon the death of the writer, and then it's the decision of the family what to do with it. Do they keep it in the family, in the family line, and pass it on? Do they dispose of it at some point? Does it then get into a museum that they decide that suddenly something that was private is now of great interest because it is, you know, it's of historic value?
Yeah. It's one of the sort of the fundamental differences of writing diaries and writing blogs, isn't it?
Yep.
I mean, so diaries, I mean, Samuel Pepys's diary would have been in his study somewhere.
Yes.
It wouldn't have been laid out for all of his guests to read.
No. And politicians often keep diaries in order to defend their political record later on.
Yeah.
So, and also to make lots of money about after they leave office, and they make a ton of money out of publishing.
So that's an example of something that's private now, but it is not going to be in the future.
Yes.
Hmm. So it's quite historical.
Histories of the unexpected. It's very historical. I want to share with you, I want to talk about the private lives of Tudor women, since I'm going to be talking about this. And in a little bit, I'll talk about, you know, how we think about that and how we get into it. But I want to start with an example of how one might construct a private life. And this is of an Elizabethan gentlewoman, a woman called Elizabeth Bourne, who on the 6th of December 1582 petitioned for a divorce from her husband, Anthony Bourne, who was one of the serious wastrels of the age. You can't imagine a more disgraceful, despicable man. We know about all of this because we have this court case about divorce. It was one of the sort of early sort of divorce cases. She wasn't allowed to divorce, but she chronicled in it all of her husband's faults. So it's basically her personal testimony that is written down by a legal clerk, and she records her disgraceful husband's taking away of another man's wife by whom he had four bastards, his refusal of her company, he refused her access to her own children, he had, and I quote, wasted his own personal wealth or substance and her ancient inheritance, all the money she'd brought in, he had sworn her death and destruction, he had attempted to blow up her house, her children, her as well, with gunpowder. He'd attempted to poison her. He'd sent a man from France, burnt in the hand, to stab her with a dagger. And on one occasion, he threatened to peel the skin off her back with a knife if she didn't release to him her jointure. And jointure is the lands that you bring into a marriage that support somebody during widowhood. And in recounting her husband's numerous women, she's particularly waspish about a woman called Anne Vaughan, who, according to Elizabeth Bourne, was most famous for her ill life, as common a harlot as any in Bridewell. And she was apparently so syphilitic that she couldn't walk. She was, Bourne wrote, not able to be removed but in a cart. The pox had so consumed her.
Oh, no.
One of the most sad things about her is that she is orphaned when she's 14, and she becomes a ward of court. And during this period, somebody who was a ward of court could basically be bought by the highest bidder. And what happens is a high-ranking official in Mary the First's reign purchases her wardship and marries her to his son. And so this is Sir John Bourne, Secretary of State under Mary. And then she ends up married to this guy who treats her monstrously. On his own mother's death, Anthony Bourne kicks his mother out of the house, kicks her into the dower house. So we know about this because of court records. So we can record all of this. There's also the reason I got into this example, first of all, was that there is a massive collection of her own private writings as well that survive, that chronicle her story. And it really is one of the most sad sort of stories that really gets us to the heart of private lives of women. You can really sort of look at the intimate details of their family life. You can have a look at what Tudor patriarchy was like. You know, this was a period when for women, if you were unmarried or you were treated appallingly by your husband, there was very little recourse. And, you know, she seems to have sort of bounced around from one family member to another with very little to support her. And she describes in one of her letters, almost like Mr. Wemmick in Dickens, sort of talked about portable property. She talks about having gold that she can sort of carry around. So there we are. There's an example of a private life of a Tudor woman.
So you're kind of, you're in that respect, you are just reliant on there being some good written sources, which allows you to open that window into the past.
Yes. Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And there are not that many of them. But there are enough for you to realise that you can start thinking about it.
Well, I mean, there are lots of them. I mean, first you need to start thinking about what is it about private life that you're interested in. If we look at it from the perspective of biographers, you know, biographers talk about the private lives of the Tudors, and basically what they're interested in is the sex and politics of, you know, Henry VIII and Elizabeth I. So they're interested in lurid details. But I think there's enough material that survives, that is either written by women themselves, diaries, letters, correspondence, all of those kinds of things, and all sorts of material sources.
Yeah.
You know, that's a really strong body of material that allows us to think about how we conceptualize privacy and private lives of women. So the degree to which we can get at intimacy and introspection, so the extent to which we can look at emotions and thoughts and feelings and desires. So rather than the sort of public outward lives, you actually are able to look at women's inner lives, religious piety, the way that they talked about ailments and illnesses, the dreamscapes. We've talked about the history of the dream in the past. To what extent can we recreate that, something that is very, very intimate? Their sex lives, even. You know, that you know, you could write a whole chapter on the sex lives of of Tudor women.
Yeah. Fascinating, isn't it? It's just having access to the right sources, isn't
yes.
it? Unsurprisingly, I'm going to take you to the world of ships.
Good. Private ships.
Well, you could do that. Privateering.
I didn't think
about that. So no. Private ships are privately owned warships, essentially. So you're, it's warships which fought alongside the state. So you have the Royal Navy, but then you can have a load of privateers who can, they have a letter of marque and they can go and... private warfare. We might have to come back and do that. But I'm not going to be talking about it in respect of that. So many years ago, shortly after I'd finished my PhD, I worked for the SS Great Britain, Brunel's wonderful passenger liner in Bristol. And I helped out with the interpretation team. And one of the jobs was to dress the cabins. And so I'm going to just talk briefly about the different... Well, it's what am I going to talk about? It's the maritime geography of privacy. No, the maritime historical geography of privacy. It's the geography of privacy on ships.
Oh, great.
It's really, really interesting.
Brilliant. Love it.
Yeah. Just quickly start off with the SS Great Britain. There's an entry of a diary here from J.M. Hardwick, who had a first-class cabin, 26th of August, 1852. So it would have been going to Australia. And this was a, you know, very, very famous ship. It was the first kind of luxury passenger liner Queen Victoria visited in 1845. Here we are. Here's his diary. Dinner was first rate, quite such as you would get at the best hotels. Soup, grouse, pigeon, veal pies, pork, ham and other meat dishes, sundry puddings and tarts and jelly, blancmange, cheese, celery, and after all that, a dessert. So his his concerns as a first-class passenger are entirely food-based, right? It's interesting and important, yes. This, because he's got his own cabin.
Ooh.
Okay.
Private dining.
Then we have, imagine making a jelly on a ship. How would that work?
So lots of gelatin, I imagine.
Just move around. It would never set.
Unless you had a very firm set jelly.
Ah.
So the more gelatin, the firmer the consistency would be. Less likely to wobble.
Here you are. This is a third-class passenger known as steerage, because you were often down where the clanking of the chains and the propeller or the rudder were. It's all quite a noisy part of the boat. So first class would have been in a nice quiet part. This is Scottish emigrant Alan Gilmore. Our berths are pretty well ventilated, but very confined and dark. He wrote in his diary, 1852. So this is the same voyage as that first-class passenger. Now, this is the key bit. The distance between our berths is 2 foot broad and 6 foot long. So confined that only one can dress at once. That's not a lot of space. So, you know, life there, I think, would have been okay as long as everyone got on with each other. And, you know, the big problem there is not necessarily the food. It's just it's how they get on with their fellow passengers. A completely different experience. So it draws a very distinct line in terms of privacy between the first class passengers and the steerage class passengers. But then there's another issue here which comes from the diaries of the SS Great Britain, which is all to do with love. So a lot of these long voyages was a chance to be romantic, to meet people. And often people would marry their fiancés when they got to where they were going. This is from Clara Aspinall of 1862. 8 or 10 unmarried ladies on board, some with parents, others under the care of our captain. As if they need protecting. He has no sooner cast anchor in Hobson's Bay than he has to deck himself in bridal array and hasten to church to perform the fatherly office of giving away a bevy of fair charges. And when I read that, it just really made me think of romance and privacy on board a ship and how that actually worked. I don't know how it worked, but there are always quiet, dark spaces on ships where you can go and have a bit of time by yourself. But it would have been particularly important for a voyage that lasts for 4 months. And if there were, you've got lots of single men on board and you've got lots of single women on board, which often happened with the colonies.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Now, just move from there to Titanic, because there's a real difference, again, the cabins, which is always fascinated me, this. So the most expensive are the parlor suites. How much would a parlor suite on Titanic have cost you, James? In dollars. In modern day money.
Oh, in modern day money?
Yeah. What were you going to blow on your trip to America?
Are we talking day rate or for the voyage?
For the voyage.
Voyage. $15,000?
$100,000. No way. Yeah. What?
Goodness me.
Cheapest one, cheapest berth in third class cabin was $350. There were not a lot of these parlor suites.
No, I bet. That's expensive.
The largest man-made moving object on Earth. You've got to pay $100,000 to get the fanciest suite.
Goodness me.
They have wardrobe rooms, private baths. Private baths, important. Private promenades. So there's a history of private walking on ships. You see, you need space to take the air. You need space to woo, don't you? Love and promenading, private walking. It all changes with second-class cabins. You have a chamber pot, you've got a wash basin, and you've got but you have to use a communal bathroom, and you would have shared up to 2 to 4 berths per cabin. Your only privacy was achieved with a curtain around your berth. Then third-class cabin, and then you've got something like 6 people in a narrow cabin. And again, they're sharing their bathroom. So you've got privacy relating to washing, as well as you've got privacy relating to sleeping and privacy relating to walking. Those are all completely different things, and they were controlled.
Let me take your privacy in ships and raise you.
Spaceships?
No. But take space into houses.
Okay.
Because a lot of the themes are very similar. And there, rather on ship, you'll have communal areas and then sort of more individual private areas with cabins. But imagine shifts in house design over time. And there's a very sort of crude chronology that you can trace from, say, a medieval hall where everything is, very communal. You have the hall, you have the sort of the chapel, the parlour. You may have a chamber, kitchen, buttery and pantry. A lot of these areas are very public and communal. In fact, the medieval hall was a very public place where guests would be invited in, travellers would be invited in to have hospitality. As we move into the 16th and 17th centuries, if we have a look at architectural plans, you can see the increase of private space. So the increase of bedchambers with little closets off them. By the 17th century, you've got the development of stairs, above and below stairs that are outside of the public rooms, that so the family could basically be in the public room. The servants wouldn't have to sort of pass through it, but would come through different sort of stairs. So there's that rise of private space.
Yeah.
Map onto that, changing social relationships between servants and, say, the family that lived in the house. Think also about how that impacts upon the family relationships between parents and children, the kind of privacy that you were talking about earlier on, the privacy of lovers to be able to find space.
Yeah.
In a packed household, where is the private space for a husband and wife? And how does that impact the kind of relationship that they have? What does that suggest about the nature of family life? We're talking here, largely about large houses. Yeah, we're talking largely about sort of private houses and, the sort of National Trust style properties. But a really interesting thing to do is to take a building that exists today and look at it through its stages and how it's developed. And one of the interesting things is looking at how over the course of the 16th and 17th century, we get this increase in domestic space with staircases, separation of public and private rooms, the rise of studies and closets. But I was really struck by what you said about the ships and about how you achieve a degree of privacy within a communal space.
Yeah.
How do you do that?
Yeah. And it'll vary. So there'll be an amazing history of privacy within certain communal spaces.
Yes.
So whether it's trains, would be really interesting. I'm always fascinated by trains. I was watching Murder on the Orient Express the other day, just wondering about what was going on with privacy on trains, how that actually worked. And everyone had their individual cabins, but the walls were completely paper thin.
Yep.
And it was very Agatha Christie-like. But the point was you could hear what was going on next door. There was an illusion of privacy. So trains, I think, is an interesting world for privacy, as it'd be similar to ships.
Even in a crowded room, sort of party, how you get privacy to, you either step outside or you put your heads together, you go into a corner.
Yeah.
And you...
It's interesting.
You know, you hop up.
That's ringing a bell. People talking in windows, people talking in corners.
People talking in windows was... There's a very well-known example of Henry VIII...
That's right.
...taking Cromwell into a window. So one of those sort of windows that you can sort of walk into and sort of taking him away from somebody to sort of confer with them. It's in Geoffrey Elton's collection of essays on the Tudor court, I think.
I bet Cicero's got something to say about privacy.
Cicero has something to say about everything.
Caesar and Cicero, particularly Cicero, I bet he plotted in secret, plotting and privacy. Where do you plot? Private from prying eyes.
We're here in your shed privately.
We are.
Recording.
Yeah. No one knows what we're doing.
No one knows what we're doing until we release it to the public.
The same, so you can do, you take that idea through. So you've got politics and secrecy. We've talked about passenger liners and secrecy. There'll be a same thing with a naval ship. So the secrecy, privacy, planning mutiny, privacy of the lower deck sailors away from the officers. How do they get their own identity and feel private and feel, there's quite an important sense of sort of personal self-worth they need to have their own identity.
Yeah,
and that's
all
to do with privacy and divisions.
But it'll
apply with armies as well. So you can, all armies across all time, I will just imagine Napoleon's invasion camp in 1805, right?
Yep.
Because we're near the anniversary of Trafalgar. But that's an example. That's an interesting camp. How did privacy work there? It's one of these brilliant examples of a subject working across history.
Yes. Privacy also links to segregation. What you talked about on the Titanic and the different sort of classes, it links to class boundaries.
Yeah.
So people being, the upper classes being private and separate from the lower social orders, women being often separated from men for various reasons throughout history. And it also has racial overtones as well.
Yeah.
You know, if you think about segregation in the United States, you know, so whites wanting privacy, in a sense, being separate from African Americans, you know, and all of this, you know, has undercurrents of control and social order that you can map across time.
And what about I would talk briefly about it, the material culture, the physical manifestation, material culture of privacy.
Yes.
And keys is one thing that I've been writing about because we're doing Histories of the Unexpected, the Vikings
just
at the moment.
Things. Yes.
And there's a chapter on keys. And
there
keys
is.
Are wonderful. So that's the, you've got a wonderful phrase. What is it? It's the material culture of access and space or something.
Yes.
So the people who have the keys control the space, they control access to certain things. And it's all to do with doors as well. You know, you get private space by securing it, by closing a door or securing a thing. And one of the great stories we found in our Vikings book was the Viking site of Birka in Sweden, massive hall of warriors. And not only have they found hundreds of arrowheads and spearheads and arrows, it's clearly a very important military site, but they found loads and loads of keys and padlocks.
Yes.
Haven't they? Some of them are big. For securing chests or something. But what fascinated me was that quite a lot of them were tiny and useless. Well, not useless, but they were tiny like the kind of padlock you would use for a teenager might secure their private diary with. It's like a little toy padlock. It does work, but it doesn't work
but
if you actually want to
get into
it.
But it's not going to stop somebody who comes and wants to force the lock. It's not going to protect it.
So archaeologists are writing about this, thinking that these locks are somehow symbolic of rank and control of power rather than actually functioning in that way, which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah, and it's also, the Viking keys are also connected to the role of women as housewives.
Yeah.
And, you know, a woman who had the keys to the household then controlled the household space, could control access, could protect goods that were inside of it.
And that's intricately linked to privacy, because the house is your private domestic space. And so controlling that, you have these keys, which actually some open doors, some didn't open doors, some were symbolic, some didn't. It's a wonderful world out there.
There's a fascinating article I read years ago, probably 20 years ago, which was about, it was about an aristocratic household full of rooms, all of which had doors that were lockable. And the key thing, pardoning the pun, was who controlled the keys, who had the keys to all of these spaces. The person who had the keys was the person who controlled access throughout the household.
Yeah.
I mean, the other thing is, if we're moving on from the material culture, and we've looked at the sort of physical environment of space on ships and in architecture, we've looked at the material culture, we've thought about keys, locks, doors, entry points. Think about, let's go back to documents.
Yeah.
Where does privacy lie in documents? We've talked about the issue of private documents that now are public. What forms of documents did people write on in a private way? Particularly when you don't have access to paper.
A lot of my private stuff is on scraps. There you are.
Yes.
That's a private list for me.
Yes.
And that's for my own eyes only, and it's not for anyone else. And it's by my desk, and it's a completely illegible gibberish script.
And so that's ephemeral.
Yeah.
That's something that will be thrown away.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of work being done on waste paper and private sort of ephemera and how we recapture that.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the most interesting things I've worked on, I may have spoken about this in the past, is books that were really important within the household, particularly Bibles. And family Bibles were a site for people to write down quite personal, private information. But privacy there is defined as communal, because it's private within the family, rather than so the divide is between the family and public. But it's not private as in the sense of the individual. So when the other kind of thing that you could think about is, when do individually private documents come around, you know, things that people want to keep to themselves. You know, when do we see the rise of the private diary? It tends to be, you know, we tend to think about it as connected to the Reformation and a new form of religion that encourages introspection. Now, Catholics have always encouraged introspection through confession, but it's something that's been oral and in between two people. But when we see the rise of Protestantism, people are forced to commune with themselves, their own inner world. And it's recording that in private spiritual journals where I think we start seeing the rise of development of a private individual self.
Hmm. That's a big thought to end with.
It is a big thought to end with. It's privacy. It's all about the history of the Reformation and gloves. Private gloves.
Yeah. It's good. I really enjoyed this. How can we do it? We've done secrets and privacy. What can we do as a third one, as a trio for these?
Honour. Silence.
Hiding.
Hiding. Oh, hiding would be great.
Yeah.
Let's spitball hiding very quickly.
Okay, go.
Jesuits. Priest holes.
Mm-hmm. Second World War, Anne Frank.
Yes. Cupboards.
Yep.
Kids' games. Hide and seek.
Oh, that's really interesting. Chimneys. People hiding in chimneys.
People hiding in chimneys.
In chests.
Horror stories, ghosts.
Yeah. Maybe we can cover it in our Halloween special.
Yes.
Hiding under floorboards.
Ooh, yes.
And knocking and sounds. And
I remember that. One of the most painful...
Well, it's all to do with searching as well, isn't it?
Yes.
Terrifying.
Searches.
It's to do with terror.
Schindler's List. Do you remember in Schindler's List where they go into the communal toilets?
Yeah.
And there are little boys' heads poking out of the...
But that's to do with abuse hiding as well. People hiding, physically hiding from... And, from violent people. And nightmares.
Yes.
Oh, let's do hiding.
Hiding.
Okay, that's hiding. Hiding next. If you enjoyed this chat, I hope you did. There's many, many more. Check out the rest of our podcast. We've got over 90. We've got to decide on what we're going to do for our 100th.
We've got to decide what we're going to release next. We've just recorded about 5 million of these things all at the same time. We've got to think of an order.
Yeah, okay. Listen to those and check out our book, Histories of the Unexpected, which we're very proud of. And it's got 30 different topics and they're all linked to each other in very clever ways. And we're working on a couple more, and depends when you're listening to this, but check us out on our website to see if we're doing a live show near you, historiesoftheunexpected.com.
We are also on Twitter, Unexpected Pod. We're on Flickr, we're on Instagram, we're on Facebook. We have a YouTube channel.
Just come and find us.
Come and find us. Histories of the Unexpected.
Thanks a lot for listening, guys. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.